It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And sounds a little bit like we're in a hollow to me today. But yeah, it's better. I don't know. My headphone plugs. It's about 800 years old, I think, and it's showing some signs of wear and tear. Kind of like, you know, me.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yep. Anyway, we are back in the studio again and not going anywhere for the next hour. So I suggest you all stick around too. For all the regulars, thanks so much. We depend on you, as you know. And for the new people, if you found us by accident or if you just kind of left your heart out when somebody was telling that they used us or knew of us or listened to us and you decided to try it, I hope it sticks with you because we're always here. Angela was talking on the show prior to ours that she's somewhere in the 600s of shows. We're not quite up to 500 by my count.
We're at 490.
490, okay. And out of those, does that count the weeks that we weren't here?
Yes.
Okay. Out of those, there have been five times we didn't do the show. Two of them were one year when Christmas and New Year's Day fell on a Saturday. Two of them, the town was evacuated during hurricanes, and the other one happened over I think it was a Thanksgiving weekend, and the station couldn't find any live help to produce it. So other than that, we've been live every single time since we started the show in early 2015, and you can pretty much bet that no matter how many replays you hear on those other stations, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, tune in here, and your chances of being treated to a live show are close to 100%. That's the way we like it. Why else would you do live radio except to be able to answer questions on air, on the spot, have people come up and bring ideas to the forefront and discuss them, because there is always a lot going on. And in this particular season, with an election coming and these strange economics and so on, I think that it's going to be something of a ride for the next few weeks. But meanwhile, we're plugging right along, right?
Yeah, it was an interesting week. I think the word for the week is rotation. We definitely saw some rotation out of popular trades and into less popular trades. That didn't mean that everything that was up went down. In fact, all three indexes were up this week. It was just the things that were up the most were some, I guess you could say, surprising asset classes.
Yeah, mine, for a change.
That's good. The NASDAQ was still up, but it lagged behind the Dow, which led the way higher. I haven't said that in many, many weeks.
It has been a long time.
The Dow gained 625 points, or 1.6%, to end the week over 40,000 again, which is mildly exciting. Not that it really means anything.
It had it going on all day long, too, like it was going to set a record.
Yeah, and it just back. Barely was by less than a point that it exceeded that threshold.
Kind of got to think it's coming this next week, don't we?
Maybe. We'll see. The NASDAQ was up just 0.2%, and the S&P was right in the middle at just under 1%. The real winners of the week were small and mid-cap stocks. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index was up more than 6.1%, and the S&P 500 mid-cap, or 400, whatever, S&P's mid-cap index was up 4.4%.
That kind of reminds me of natural gas. It went up so far, it's down to really low.
That's true.
Or up to really low, I guess you would say.
The other way around here, yeah. But a great week in small and mid-cap stocks. And you will see that most of the trading this week seemed to be positioning for lower interest rates, which is that kind of trade we've been anticipating for quite some time, just weren't sure when it was going to start happening. Why did it start this week? I'm not 100% sure.
Well, in my notes, it says the market is almost 100% for a cut in September. I, on the other hand, have serious reservations.
I'm at 50-50 on it, I think. I
was 50-50 last week, and I'm with you. I didn't change this week, given the numbers that we got. The analysis of those numbers that we got doesn't hold water.
It's I don't think there's a real clear need for one. The argument I could make for one is that things are softening, and historically the Fed has been late to the party, late to react. So if you see the numbers softening, they may have a bias towards reacting sooner rather than later, so they don't miss the boat again like they have the last 100 or so times.
There is a pattern developing here.
Yes, yes, I would say so. Some more rotation occurred in the S&P, with the S&P 500 growth index down 5 basis points during the week and the value index up more than 2.5%. It had been all growth lately, so that was kind of a big switch. While small and mid-cap growth were up big this week, they were also outperformed by their value counterparts. The S&P 500 equal weight index outperformed the actual index by a pretty wide margin, gaining almost 3%. That is something we haven't seen in a long time either. It's been all weighted towards the mega cap tech stocks. This week was the opposite. Inside the S&P 500, the two sectors that were up the most this year, technology and communication services, performed the worst this week, with communication services down 1.65% and technology up 0.4%. Those were two of the weaker performers. Consumer staples and energy were also towards the bottom of the pack. The best performing sector was real estate. I had to double check that when I saw it this morning. It was up 4.4%. But if you follow what I was saying earlier about these trades being all about lower interest rates, that would make sense. Followed by utilities up 4%. So those are bond proxies when rates are low. So again, that makes sense. International stocks performed very well, with Mexico leading the way higher, up almost 8%. Hong Kong gained 4.6% and Israel was up 3.9%. I couldn't find an international market that was down this week after a quick scan, so that was kind of interesting. That doesn't happen very often. The All World Index was up 2%, while emerging markets were up just over 2%. Commodities were down over 2% this week, with oil, silver, and natural gas all falling. Fixed income, on the other hand, was up about 80 basis points, with long treasuries gaining almost 1.5%. So again, all of those things consistent with future lower interest rates. The market has been pretty lopsided lately. We've talked about that a bit last week, and we've been really looking for a reversal of that. I think we saw a bit of it this week, with the mega cap tech stocks underperforming. Well, value stocks, mid-cap stocks, and small-cap stocks all gained. If the market continues that type of trading and the economy stays healthy without slipping into recession, I could see this rally continuing. And that's good news.
Statistically, a good start leads to a good finish. Doesn't make it necessarily true. But
that also doesn't rule out volatility in September and October, which I would almost be willing to bet on.
Oh, yeah. Give you that one every day. All right, much more to say right after a quick break where we can pay some bills and don't go anywhere. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we do have lines open, 904-222-8255. And we have a trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. And you can call Ken at 904-636-7888. I got a few choices today, and I haven't really decided which one to use, so I'm going to make a snap decision here, and we're going to talk about changing interest rates and the impact on bonds. Now, most people know, and we've been talking about this for many, many years, that bond prices and interest rates work in inverse. We always call it the seesaw or teeter-totter effect, where on one side you have the price of the bond, existing price, and on the other side you have the interest rate. So if the interest rate goes up, the bond price goes down, and vice versa. So the question, if market interest rates go up 1%, a 20-year bond will fall in value by $107, Now, if market rates drop 1%, how much will that same 20-year bond price rise? It's a whole number, and I'm not going to tell you much else. But it does work that way. Rates go up, price goes down. Rates go down, price goes up. Back to the market for just a moment. There, I mentioned that frequently there is a good second half when there's a good first half. Here's a stat that I took some comfort in this morning. The S&P 500 is now up 57.5% for this current bull market. It is nowhere near the average bull market of 114% rise, or even the median bull market of 76.7. You notice that vast difference between the average and the median. That's that statistical thing that we talk about a lot. The average is merely all of the occurrences divided by the number, added up and then divided by the number of occurrences, where the median is that number that says there were the same amount that were bigger than this, that there were that were lower than this. So whichever one you want to look at, there's a lot of room to roll to get it up to the median or the average either way. And it has lasted so far 637 days. The average is 1,011. So in theory, this could march right on, although I suspect Adam is very correct about it'll probably do so, but it'll probably do so with a lot of volatility.
Yeah, it seems like the day that traders return from the Hamptons in the fall, it gets volatile.
Yeah, they all say, huh? Okay, one more thing. If you're an investor with some discipline, I guess, and you have sort of a targeted balance in your account, you know, the 50-50, 60-40, whatever it is, and you've been sitting on a lot of money in the money market because, quite frankly, that's been a lot of fun lately, picking up your 5%+ in the money market. But the difference between a money market and a bond is that if rates do start to soften now, those money market rates will follow it all the way down.
Well, rates are softening. That's pretty clear.
I'm absolutely certain. Adam's on top of the rate thing probably more than anybody because he's doing a lot of the trading for clients and so on. So for those of you with a lot of money on the sideline in the money markets, and I'm one of them, by the way, I think it's time to start talking about slowly regaining your position in bonds. And you will see, as the trivia question shows, the leverage factor in bonds. It has to do with the duration of the bond. And you can learn more about all of that by either coming in to talk to us, or you can follow it on any number of websites. But I think it's time, and I don't mean Monday morning call your financial person and say, sell all my money markets and buy bonds. I don't mean that. It is time to start looking forward and saying, okay, let's get back to a more normal environment. Because something that we've been seeing a lot in the last year or so, this has been a three-year period where bonds have just stunk up the place.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to mention this. The three-year return for bonds from the end of last June to the end of this June is just over or negative three, just over three, negative 3%. Excuse me.
And that just doesn't happen.
Yeah. And also on the stock side of things, it's not that much better on the three-year. This leads me to believe that there's more room to grow. If you look at iShares allocation models, they have three. One's a conservative, one's a moderate, one's an aggressive. The conservative is still negative by 12 basis points on a three-year average, 0.77 positive on the moderate, and then on the aggressive, 4% return annualized over 3 years. That's not great.
That is definitely not great.
And not even anywhere near the historic norms for those funds.
No. In fact, we've been getting some questions and I guess just some discussion about, a lot of you have heard of this guy, Harry Dent. Harry Dent is he's called the perpetual bear and a few other things. What I call him generally can't be said on the radio without risk of some kind of a lawsuit. But I guess you'd call him a character. He lives in Puerto Rico because there's a tax loophole in Puerto Rico that he takes advantage of where he pays very little. But his real job is, you ready for this? Selling newsletters, as I so often caution people. I also tell them when people call us or write to us and say, hey, do you see what Harry Dent said? I said, what year? If you type in Harry Dent and market crash and put any year you want to in there. So for years, I've been collecting these articles, and it's very interesting looking back. One of them, I'm not picking on Harry. There's a lot of people that do this. He's just probably the most vocal, maybe. Right now, instead of sticking with last year's prediction that said it would definitely be the big daddy of them all, market crash in 2024, he's now gotten that pushed out to 2025, about May. Still going to happen, though. And the market will lose 80% of its value, and you got to get out of stocks and all that. And it's one after another in these things. Well, finally, there's a guy out there that people in our business know pretty well. His name is Rick Edelman. He's a very successful and very sincere and intelligent guy who has worked up a business and has really, really succeeded. And the reason I'm bringing this up is he wrote a wonderful article. I can't remember what he published it in, but it was called something like Believe Harry Dent if you want to, but he's always wrong. And he went back through some of the things. The one thing that I really thought was excellent, on July 7th, 2021, he said, we're in a deflationary period like the 1930s.
Wait a second.
I don't remember the 30s, but I've read about them, and it seemed to me like this isn't like that.
No.
Yeah. So just want everybody to always understand that when you read these things, the crash of a lifetime things, those are headline grabbers. They're there for one reason, that's to draw you in. But don't act on these things. It just doesn't happen the way they say it will. On the other hand, he said 2022 was going to be a horrible year. And by God, 2022 was a horrible year. So, good job, Harry. He also predicted the Japanese crash in the 80s. Got that one right, too. So, what do they say about the blind pig and the acorn?
Well, if you make enough predictions,
exactly,
one of them's bound to come true.
Yeah, and if you forget to talk about the other ones,
yeah,
you're a winner.
Especially once they pass and don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's been mostly good news on the inflation front lately. There's good and bad to that, though. I know everyone is wanting lower inflation, and you can count me in that group.
Oh, yeah.
But the one area where it may not be so welcomed is in the Social Security COLA estimate.
Oh,
that dropped to 2.7 from 3.2 last year. So significantly lower increase, still an increase this year, but much lower. That's the estimate. I don't know what it will actually come out at, but that, so there is, it's a double-edged sword. You know, there's good and bad on things like this, and that's definitely one that will not be as welcome to seniors as the actual inflation shrinking.
No, and these people, I don't know, they're just driven, I guess, to make forecasts like that. So I've been watching the forecast for this thing come down and down and down. Does it do any good at all, really, to say here's what we're expecting and then change it every month? I don't know. I'm just one guy sitting out there reading the headlines. But the only thing that matters is when they look back on September 30th, 1 year, the change in the consumer price index from a year ago on September 30th, the fiscal year end of the government, that's the only number that matters because that's where they derive it from. And you've all heard me in the past complaining about the chained CPI that we were forced to move to, which undersells inflation because it imputes a change in behavior on older people. It says, well, if they can't afford steak, they're just going to change and buy hamburger. Which, by the way, has happened in our household. make really good burgers, though. But I don't like it when they're using manipulation like that to change the lifestyles of people, and it's happening, and now they wanted to do it again, and I object. But I'm just one guy, as Regis would say. All right, we'll be right back right after the break. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the trivia question is open, as are the lines, 904-222-8255. Talking about bond prices now, because interest rates are getting set to start moving. If a 20-year bond is in a market where the rate goes up 1%, the market value will fall $107. But if that same 20-year bond is in a market where interest rates come down by 1%, how much will it rise? This feeds back into my theory of starting to get some balance back in your portfolios because of the changes in the times. It's silly season, as everybody knows, when the political season gets hot and crazy. And we're setting up for what is probably going to be an epic battle in the tax arena for next year. The results of this election are going to determine some very important things to you and to me and to all of us. Number one being that after next year, the new tax rates, the cuts, the Trump cuts as they're called, from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, they're set to sunset, which means we would all get a tax increase, which on average would run something like $2,400. And it's going to really hurt the economy and really hurt the middle class badly. And, of course, you're being lied to about that and pretty much everything else. But it's not the only thing going on in taxes right now. You know recently that, I don't know how long this has been discussed or if they just kind of happened on it, but Trump now is on this thing about tips, not taxing tips. And it has been discussed here and there, but it was never really on my radar very much until recently. And I think there's something to it. I don't think it's going to cost that much first off. You know and I know that the percentage compliance on tips is probably less than 99%.
I disagree. I think that it used to be that way when tips were in cash. Now
it's
tips
getting tougher
on credit cards, yeah, and it's too trackable. So I think the compliance, yeah, is probably way up.
Yeah, you probably read about that part, which makes this even more important,
yeah,
to people who work in that environment. So I just want to weigh in that I thought it was very creative and a really, really decent idea. And it's something that will separate one side from the other in the big discussion that's coming up. There are a couple of different proposals to eliminate the income tax altogether. Of course, the fair tax has been there since forever, but it'll never get anywhere because it's too easy to demagogue. But the new one is tariffs, and you're getting a lot of ugliness about that too. But one of Trump's proposals, just a little something to run up the flagpole and see who salutes, but eliminate the income tax in favor of a 10% tariff on all imported goods. And, of course, the bunch of usual economic laureates like Paul Krugman,
of course,
never gets anything right, never has, never will. Oh, my God, it'd be so inflationary, and the market would crash, and on and on and on. I would like to point out that from its inception in 1776 until the passage of the 16th Amendment, I believe, in 1916, we didn't have an income tax. Things were done on tariffs, and things were pretty good, thank you very much. They also say that this would cost the middle-class people so much. Well, if you ask people if they would settle for paying a little bit more for their goods and services every day, but they didn't have to pay any income tax, they'd probably mull it over pretty seriously, wouldn't you think?
I would think so.
That would be a lot of cash in people's pockets. So I think what you're going to see, as I mentioned, it's going to be a real dogfight in the halls of Congress and in the administration as to what tax plan actually gets passed. My prediction is that we'll probably get rid of the tax cuts at the upper levels because people can't seem to stand the success of successful people. It's getting so bad that even millionaires are saying that successful people should pay more. It breaks my heart, and I don't know what to do about it. Hopefully, the push to get economic education back in the schools will result in someday helping that situation. But I don't know. You know where I stand. They couldn't care less where I stand, and that's the truth. But I think we need to really think about it and make those tax cuts permanent. You know, the whole thing, those of you who follow politics a bit, the only reason this is happening is because the arcane budgeting rules in the Congress require that 10-year window. So they put the sunset in there, so the numbers look good after that, knowing full well that in a good situation that it's going to be changed anyway, but they have to lie about it up front to get it through because you have to, quote, pay for things. I also contend that you can't pay for anything until you stop $1 trillion of spending every 100 days.
That would help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you literally cannot pay for anything when you're borrowing borrowing $1 trillion in 100 days.
No.
You just got to stop spending.
Did you see what happened on Sunday? You didn't because you were home. But if you had been at an airport, you would have seen 3,013,413 people go through checkpoints. That was a record for the day. The previous high was in 2019. That was just over 2.8 million. And last year was 2.9 million. So we blew it out of the water, basically.
Is that a sign of a recession coming?
It just doesn't seem like it.
Well, and you were telling us last week, too, that what you were seeing as you were doing your East Coast tour earlier this summer, that it's all busy.
I've probably taken 6 to 8 flights recently within the last year. Not one of them has had an empty seat.
This really is a forecaster's nightmare. There's no question about it. But meanwhile, that does speak well for the possibility of a continuation of a reasonably good market. And let's face it, that's the most important thing to most of us.
Yeah. I had an interesting thing on inflation, too.
Yeah.
Walmart had rolled out something I'll title as interesting this week. You may have some different words for it. It's electronic price shelf labels. And they did it, but the company line was, it was about improving efficiency and customer satisfaction as well as saving the environment.
Mm-hmm. Unless it changes between the time you take it off the shelf and the time you get to the checkout.
Well, but the truth is, does it do any of those things? No. It lets Walmart charge you the most they can at any given time. Exactly. That's all it does.
Price at time of delivery is taking on a new meaning, isn't it?
I mean, that's insane.
What burger chain was it?
Wendy's is looking at something similar, actually.
Yeah, they got a little feedback from the public, and I think that proposal got put to bed.
Yeah. I am not big on government stepping in and controlling these things, but when it comes to changing prices hourly or by the minute, I'm okay with dynamic tolling on the freeway. That makes sense.
Yeah, agreed.
But if you're walking through a store, the price should not change from the time you walk in to the time you walk out.
Yeah, I'm only good with that tollway stuff if there's a lane you can take where you don't get the express lane, but you don't pay for it.
Oh, yeah.
It might take you forever.
That's how that works.
In other words, you got to have alternatives.
Yeah.
Choice is choice. But, yeah, I agree with you completely. All right, you can't go a day these days without hearing the words Project 2025. How many of you know what it is? It is everywhere and is being used by the usual bunch of idiots to try to show that Donald Trump is a monster, that Republicans are just horrible, returning back to the Nazi days of yesteryear and on and on and on. Project 2025 is a Heritage Foundation 900-page essay, basically, with a list of suggestions of things that they would like to bring up and have discussed among the conservatives in Congress and the administration. It does not say that it will eliminate abortions. It does not say any of those things that idiots like Mark Hamill posted. He wrote up a summary of it that he made up, and it's everything you could possibly say in the worst way possible. Do not believe it. Trump is not associated with it. The Republican Party is not associated with it. It is the Heritage Foundation trying to bring up some just discussion about topics of interest, including smaller government and including perhaps lower tax rates and things like that. And if you want to read something funny, look up an interview with Ben Shapiro and Pencil Neck, what's his name from California?
Schiff.
Yeah. Shapiro is just priceless. I would love to be able to think like that guy thinks sometimes, as fast and as funny. But it's really good. So anyway, when you start hearing more and more the term Project 2025, and it sounds like we're going back to the halcyon days of the 30s in Germany, just know that it's nothing more than gaslighting the public, period. And just want to heads up to everybody. I do want to get into some taxation things that are my proposal for them, but don't have time to do it now. When we come back from the break, Adam's got one of his millionaire series going on, which is always fun. And then I want to talk about just some little tweaks to the tax system that would make life better for everyone listening to this broadcast as we speak. I think they're very good because I wrote them. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Banway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Banway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Banway.
And I'm Adam Banway.
And the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the question remains, if interest rates go down by 1%, how much will a 20-year bond price rise? And, of course, you know that bonds are delineated by $1,000 increments, unless you say otherwise. So it's the number based on the 1,000. All right, a millionaire is made every once in a while.
Yep, I haven't done one of these for a while, so I'll just remind people the reason that I started this. I just wanted to show that perhaps the American dream is not dead, that there are people every year born into poverty who make great success out of themselves. These are extreme examples, but all of these people were born with modest means, and through hard work and great ideas and incredible work ethic, were able to become really billionaires in most cases. Some were millionaires, but many were billionaires. So this young man was born in the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston in 1933. He is a Ukrainian Jewish immigrant, and his father was, and the Welsh coal miner. His father drove a taxi and his mother ran a knitting shop. At the age of 12, he first showed his entrepreneurial spirit when he borrowed $200 from his uncle to buy a license to sell newspapers in Boston. He later borrowed $10,000 from the same uncle to start a candy machine business. So his uncle was wealthy, but his family was not. He attempted to go to college at the City College of New York, but it wasn't for him, and he didn't graduate. He then tried trade school to become a court reporter, but that didn't work out either, so he joined the Army. When his commitment to the Army was fulfilled, he started a toiletry kit business, and then a chemical de-icing business, and then a charter tour business. He was something of a serial entrepreneur, creating more than 50 businesses over his lifetime. This led to him becoming a millionaire fairly early in life, although he was also on the verge of bankruptcy twice in his 30s. In the 1970s, this entrepreneur started the Comdex trade shows for the computer industry, which became one of the largest in the world through the 80s and 90s. He eventually sold that business to SoftBank, and his share of the profit was over $500 million. Ooh. In 1988, he purchased the Sands Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas for $110 million and built the Sand Expo and Convention Center. Just a few years later, while honeymooning in Venice with his second wife, he came up with the idea for the Mega Resort Hotel. So in 1996, he raised the Sands and built the Venetian for $1.5 billion. Following the success of the Venetian, he led a project to bring a Vegas-style resort to Macau. The Las Vegas Sands Casino opened in May of 2004 and was a huge success, with his $254 million investment recouped in 1 year.
Wow.
Because of this, when he went public in December of 2004, his personal wealth increased by 14x.
Oh.
Several other casinos followed the Macau project, including the Venetian Macau and the Marina Bay Sands in Singapore, which is the 12th most expensive building in the world. Due to his involvement with unions at his Las Vegas casinos, this millionaire began donating heavily to Republican campaigns. He is quoted as saying that he didn't believe in rich people influencing politics, but as long as guys like Soros are doing it, he would too. Unfortunately, Sheldon Adelson passed away at his home in Malibu, California in 2021. He was buried in Israel, where he arrived with the flags of both the U.S. and Israel on his coffin. Benjamin Netanyahu attended his funeral. His net worth at the time was somewhere north of $30 billion. Not bad for the son of a Jewish immigrant taxi driver in Boston.
Not bad.
No. Pretty, wow. Pretty amazing.
It really is. What a story. Only in America, as they say. All right. Speaking of George Soros, Uma, what's her name?
Abedin or something?
Abedin.
Something like that, yeah.
She snared herself a little gig for at least for a while.
Yeah.
She's about to marry the son of George Soros. So let's see. She started her career following Hillary Clinton around with a pooper scooper, and now she's moved on to marrying billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Uma, go for it. She probably doesn't miss Anthony Weiner all that much, huh?
Probably not.
That's funny. All right, when were you first made aware of the proposal? I know it goes back a long ways, decades ago, that says we should eliminate the marriage penalty in the tax system.
I've been hearing that since I followed politics.
First time I remember clearly the discussion on this thing was during the Reagan administration. So you'd have been a young, very young man.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we have made some progress toward it. And then every once in a while, you go two steps forward, but then you take a step back, too. So it's not always been steady.
Definitely.
But my proposal for this upcoming year, where taxes are going to be really, really seriously and hotly debated, I'm sure, my proposal for the conservative element out there who thinks more about taxes along the lines I do, let's eliminate the marriage penalty in the whole code. Now, you might wonder, we still have one? I found a few places.
There's several, yeah.
Yeah. Mandated federal tax withholding, that's FICA and Medicare, they're applied to each earner. So if you had two households with the same income, earned by two or earned by one, only one, in this case, would have to pay the FICA and Medicare, and the other ones would pay twice.
Yeah, that one I would argue it is two separate benefits that you will get later in life.
So I'll counter-argue. If the heavy earner, the one, is married, the spouse gets all those benefits anyway without paying.
Mm. So
it's built in?
If it's, yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know.
I say we charge it once. Once per taxpayer. A taxpayer is a tax return, whether it's married, filing jointly, or single.
Okay.
That's just one. All right, those who use the standard deduction have achieved fairness because it got to double what the single was in. However, when you move over out of the standard deduction and itemized deductions, and you look at the SALT cap, state and local taxes cap, that cap is $10,000.
Once per return.
Per return.
Yep.
Why isn't it $20,000 for a married couple with two incomes?
Don't know.
With or without two incomes, for that matter, because it could be one of them that's doing it. That is a marriage penalty, in my humble opinion. Medicare tax of 0.9% above incomes of certain limits applies at $200,000 for singles, but only $250,000 for married.
Yeah.
That's a $150,000 gap at 0.9%. Medicare premiums, in addition to the base rate, the IRMA adjustments that we talk about so often, they apply to the top two brackets differently than the lower four brackets. So at $250,000 lower in the next to the highest bracket and the next bracket after that, the highest and the next to it, you get a $250,000 marriage penalty per household. Nice, huh? Alternative minimum tax, which should have been repealed long ago and keeps rearing its ugly head back. The exemption for a single is $85,700. Married is $133,300. That's $38,200 short of parity. Long-term capital gains and qualified dividends tax rates have 15% applied to singles up to $492,000. Married, $553,000. That's a $430,000 marriage penalty.
Mm-hmm.
IRA deductibility phases out for single filers at $87,000, but only $143,000 for married, short of parity by $31,000. Roth contribution eligibility phases out at $161,000 for single, but only $240,000 for married, $82,000 short of parity. There, guys, I gave you some free advice. How to win more elections. Let's get rid of the marriage penalty in the tax code.
Yeah, especially when it so often requires two working spouses to maintain a household these days.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost, there are very few households where only one person works.
Yeah, in fact, when Mom and I were young, we spent a lot of time talking to people who were just starting families and such, and there was always the question back then, because it was the 70s, and it was becoming vogue for the woman to go get a job. And we sat down with several people, and we would itemize the income and the cost of it. And most of the people that we dealt with figured out that by taking a second job and having childcare and clothes and cars and all those things, they were making between 50 cents and a dollar an hour coming home after all expenses. And you could still pull it off on one, but what happened over time is things got so expensive that you virtually could not make it on one salary from that time on. So we're literally forcing people to do work that they're not getting paid for, and that not paid well for anyway. But if you look at it now with the cost of childcare, I honestly don't know how anybody can make it if they're young now and trying to do all those things.
Well, I mean, the cost of childcare has gone up dramatically, but if you have two sort of not high earners, but even mid-level to high earners, it definitely makes sense to do childcare, even at those high wages. But, man, is it a relief when it's gone.
No, I can imagine. All right, we're down to the last few seconds. Your 20-year bond will go up $126 on $1,000 when the interest rate comes down one. That shows you a little guideline toward revamping your portfolio, because your money market will not do that. So let's start taking advantage of it. As I said, it doesn't have to be Monday morning, but start thinking about it in those terms. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week at the same time. This is